Good afternoon, Joshua Alexander Caldwell. Welcome on VH Berries.
Yeah, thanks, Victor. Thanks for having me.
I am extremely, extremely grateful. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I'm down in New York State. It's a little rainy. Looks like we're gonna have rain for the next couple of days, but you know, otherwise I'm doing all right.
Absolutely. And right from the beginning, I truly think that between straw goji, blue or raspberries, your favorite one is probably the huckleberry.
Yeah, you think so?
Absolutely, because alongside Batman and Robin Hood, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is a story that shaped the Caldwell pictures in an impeccable manners.
Well, it's true. In a funny way, you know, when you're a little kid and you live on sort of the edge of suburbia, and you have tons of woods and tons of places to go explore, like your imagination gets to run wild. And as you pointed out, you know, when I was younger, I had a love for movies and I saw a bunch of different movies. And one of the things I would love to do is come back to the neighborhood and get the kids together and reenact those stories. And Huckleberry Finn was definitely one of them.
It was definitely one of them, Joshua Alexander Caldwell. And I was so curious about it that I had actually a copy of that novel with me right now, because this story is a picaresque novel genre of prose fiction. Can you tell us a little bit more about what this story told you?
I mean, I'll be honest, I don't know how much it really taught me. You know, I think it was just, you know, even less as a novel, like it was really just like the movie, right? And so what the movie was a real sense of adventure. And I think that, you know, that coupled with other movies like Batman, Robin Hood, you know, what else? I mean, even like Newsies, right? Like, I mean, these just these movies that were really I saw when I was younger, you know, even, ridiculous movies like Three Ninjas and like kids movies and like all this kind of stuff. It was really like, I mean, if you want to talk about Huckleberry Finn, I don't know that much about it. I know Elijah Wood was in it, you know, but I think it was just that sense of like, it's outside, it's an adventure. You know, Huckleberry's like young, you're right, he's not like an adult. And so it was something that like felt like, oh, this is like reenactable. Whereas like, if I'm going to pretend to be Batman, that's really not the same if I'm a 10-year-old kid, you know? And so that was one of really many things that really connected with me and sort of let me just, you know, use my imagination and play act these stories with the neighborhood kids.
Absolutely, Joshua Alexander Caldwell. But something that story told you for sure is the word adventure from the title, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. You took this word very seriously because you made your life one, an adventure. And during this adventure, while maintaining a steady velocity of around 150 miles per hour, there was an unexpected layover in 2014.
That's correct. Yep, that's correct. I like your style, man. It's really fun. I love how you bring this stuff in. Leading up to it a little, I you know, spent some formative years trying to figure out how to make movies. And, you know, this was at a time when you didn't have what you have now, which is YouTube and, you know, access to all kinds of information. I mean, if you want to figure out how to make something, you know, it's not that hard. You go on the internet and it takes you 3 seconds to look it up. But back in sort of those late 80s, 90s, even late 90s, early 2000s, there just wasn't that same kind of information available. So you had to kind of figure it out on your own. And at the time it was, you know, watching behind the scenes of Blu-rays, or not even Blu-rays, of DVDs, and trying to figure out like how things worked. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to do that. And as a result, I built up a sort of a level of experience making films that was really like self-taught and driven by having no money and not having access to all of the things that, you know, normal movie making has available, you know? And so it was really about trying to figure it out. And that ended up really helping me when I made my first film, Layover, which you so kindly pointed out, which was a movie that I made for $6,000. And it was my first feature film. And we shot it all over Los Angeles. We were on airplanes, we were in airports, we were in hotels, we were in clubs, we were on the backs of motorcycles. We were really all over the place, which was in a way like flipping the typical approach to these kind of low budget movies that everybody does, which is they go and make, a film that's one location with two actors. And as a result, they make these films that are very, very limited. They can still be good, but they're fairly limited in their scope. And they put a lot of money, whatever money they might have, they put it into crew and they put it into all the stuff that happens behind the scenes as opposed to what's on screen. And with Layover, it was really like born out of a desire both to make a feature film. I had not made a feature film at that point. And also just to, I'd been learning how to use what was there, shooting with the Canon 5D, making use of available light, and doing it with a very, very small crew, sometimes just myself. And so as a result, I really figured out, hey, there's a way to make a feature film with a crew of 1 to 4 people using this type of camera that may allow us to shoot anywhere. And as I just mentioned, we were able to shoot everywhere. The film opens on an airplane landing in LAX, and then it proceeds from there. And so we were really able to sort of stretch our budget and create a real scope to the film that, you know, might not have otherwise been there had we tried to make the film in a traditional way. And so it was a really, you know, I mean, again, it being my first feature, it certainly is going to, leave a lasting impression. But, you know, even to this day, I get people either, you know, asking me how he did it, or, you know, saying that it was something that inspired them to go out and make their own films as well.
Layover is definitely going to have a lasting impact on a lot of memories. And to begin with the storyline, this is probably Joshua Alexander Caldwell, one of the easiest movie I had to watch because it is in French.
There you go.
Can you explain the meaning behind that? And I can make a direct connection with the background of Juliet, Simone, because this is where they are from.
Yes. So the French was interesting. There was a couple reasons why I sort of landed on doing it this way. One, I had years before, there was a filmmaker who had made a movie called Maria Full of Grace, and that movie was shot entirely in Spanish. And I remember very distinctly a lot of the PR and a lot of the news around that movie was, this film's entirely in Spanish, but the director didn't speak Spanish, right? So you're like, oh, that's interesting. It was just something that, like, you know, these PR and news companies had really focused on. I was like, okay, that's an interesting angle. The other thing that was really cool was I'd been doing a couple other things, low budget series or web series or something like that. And we decided to start using we wanted to create an international feel to it. So we started using other languages. And that seemed to work really well. And as a result of doing that, I ended up meeting Natalie Faye, who stars in Layover, and I'd worked with her before, and I knew that she spoke French, and I said, okay, that's kind of interesting. And but the other thing that I gravitated towards was this notion of making a foreign language film that's set in the United States. Right. Typically, when you see a foreign language film, it takes place in another country, and fine, that makes sense. But I'd never really seen, I'm sure there are some, but I'd never seen or heard of a film that was in a completely different language, but took place in the United States. And that became very, very interesting to me. And so I, you know, essentially said, well, let's do that. And we looked at doing French, one, because I knew Natalie spoke French, but also it was a little bit of a nod to the French New Wave, which is kind of how we made the film. And so everything just sort of felt right. I'm sure if that I met, you know, if Natalie had spoken Italian and Bella Dane, who plays Juliet, had spoken Italian, I would have said, all right, well, let's do Italian. But in our case, it ended up being French.
It ended up being French, and it is, as you just mentioned, Joshua Caldwell, a nod to the French New Wave. The movie is in French, but the title remains in English with this very powerful word, layover, which means in any schedule transportation, a point where a vehicle has to stop, and with all the passengers having to wait or to change of vehicles. And for example, in the case of a public transit, it could take a couple minutes, but in the case of your feature film, in the case of a plane, it can take much longer, for example, an entire night.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, layover to me, the notion of it, what's interesting was I kept it in English because it is an American film, right? It's not a French film. It's not a foreign film. It is an American film. It's just in the French language. But when I looked up the and I'm sure it's incorrect, right? But like when I looked up the translation of layover in French, it said halt. Right. But I think H-A-L-T-E with the little thing over it. And I just thought that was interesting because that's basically what the movie is you've got this woman. She's traveling from Paris to Singapore. She's on a journey and she's on a journey she's not sure she wants to be on. You know, she's really sort of like reticent and she's really unsure about this future that awaits her. And normally, like once you get on that plane, once you start that journey, like there's no stopping it. It's a bit of a roller coaster, right? But this layover, this getting stuck in LA for 12 hours becomes this pause button on this journey. And she's given the opportunity, which so many of us are not given, or maybe we are given it and we don't recognize it. But she's given this opportunity to take a moment to just consider the future that she's heading towards and whether it's something she really wants. And I just found sort of the whole notion of it and the way it all came together to be an extremely fascinating idea that, you know, we're all on this journey called life. And we're all confronted by layovers at various times. For like you said, it might be as simple as a couple minute layover and on a bus. It might be overnight, you know, with a plane. But we're confronted by layovers throughout life, and it is an opportunity to sort of take a pause button, reflect, and really determine as you face down this potential fork in the road, which direction you're going to go.
Figuring out in which directions we are going to go, Joshua Alexander Caldwell, because you mentioned those two words, a pause button. But I would go further and add that from the very first frame of a layover, with the landing in the LAX airport, we can also interpret that this landing is the sign of a new departure.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
There is also one very funny character played by Hal Ozsan, playing the character of Tom and thinking that she is staying 12 hours, 12 days instead of 12 hours. Can you tell us a little bit more about Tom?
Well, yeah, I mean, and the idea behind that interaction was obviously Tom is married to Juliet. He's not French, he's American, and he's picked up a few things, but Tom just became this guy. We're like, obviously there's a bit of a foil, right? You need somebody, right? You need this guy who's kind of a jerk, because essentially Juliet and Tom's relationship and their marriage is a reflection of where Simone thinks she's going to be going, right? Like her her example of what a marriage might be. She's confronted by this, right, during this journey, because she's about to go get engaged, and she's confronted by this, what this marriage looks like, and these two people who are deeply unhappy with each other. They don't know how to communicate, right? I mean, Tom's cheating, you know, Juliet's cheating. Like, there's this whole, like, you know, element to it that's, like, just deeply, and meanwhile, there's a child in the middle of it, and you just go, like, oh, this is so, like, depressing. Like, who wants this, you know? And so Tom's just really representative of, like, not only those types of guys that you meet in LA, they're like, you know, network, you know, like executives in Hollywood and stuff like that, but also just like, you know, kind of these assholes and these jerks and these guys who are not happy with what they have and the sort of, you know, existential unhappiness that is so pervasive in that town. And also acts as sort of just a, I guess there's a bit of a wall that Simone crashes against, you know? And so, you know, yeah, it was fun to write his character.
Absolutely. Joshua Alexander Caldwell. And you mentioned the fact that the production of Layover had a very humble budget.
Yes.
For your ambition. And it led you to this idea of giving and teaching that knowledge, because if I understood correctly, this is what you're based your 6K filmmaking course on.
Yeah, absolutely. And really, it was born out of the fact that, like, again, as I mentioned, like, over the years, I mean, I made Layover 10 years ago now. And over the years, I've just consistently had people coming up to me and saying, how'd you make that film? How'd you do it for the money you had? I don't believe you did it for the money that you had. And which is really surprising to me, because at the end of the day, I always said, like, you know, what surprised me about the reaction to Layover was that I didn't think it was that impressive we made it for $6,000. I mean, the film's a drama, right? There's no special effects. There's no action. There's nothing crazy in it, you know? It's a pretty simple story, and it was a pretty simple movie to make. And so, but people still just really gravitated towards that number of $6,000. How'd you do it for $6,000? And so I just, you know, had been thinking about a course and you know, kind of came up with this idea of, like, hey, I've done this thing that's pretty unique. Not to say I'm the only one. There's certainly other people out there, but I've done something that's fairly unique, and people seem to be want to either want to know how we did it, or were incredibly inspired by it, and went on to make their own $6,000 movies or $10,000 movies or whatever that is. And I said, well, maybe I can let me see if I can take this and I can put it together into a course, because, you know, I think that one of the challenges filmmakers are facing today is that, you know, if you go to film school, if you take online film courses, you know, other than mine, you're taught a very traditional approach to filmmaking. And that traditional approach tends to be, you've got money, you're going to hire a large crew, you're going to have all this expensive equipment, and that's how movies are made. And so a lot of people feel like, I mean, Layover was born out of my struggle trying to get a movie, trying to get a budget for $100,000 or hundreds of thousands or even $1 million to make a film, and just finding myself bumping up against wall after wall after wall, trying to raise that amount of money. Because even though $1 million is not a lot of money in the film world, it's an incredible amount of money in the real world, you know? And so to justify somebody giving you $1 million, you either have to have the experience to prove that you can handle that amount of money, or you've got to have a story that's just so compelling that, like, you know, they want to give you the $1 million. And by the way, $1 million is barely enough money to make a movie properly anyway. So there's just this, like, nobody was really teaching people how to make movies for very, very little money and do it both in a smart way that allowed them to create scope and scale to their film, but also in a way that was ethical. I mean, listen, like, I put ads out there, I run ads on Facebook, I get these guys all the time that are like, oh, you must not be paying your crew, you must be cheating your actors, like, there's no way you can do this. And, you know, the fact is there is a way to do it. They get pissed when I say, you know, oh, well, you gotta buy the course to find out, but I'm like, why? I'm not giving it away for free. Like, I've spent a decade building up this knowledge, spending money to build this knowledge, and you know, frankly, $50 or $100, you know, is nothing. You've got film schools out there charging kids $50,000 a year, you know, and with the same promise of, oh, you'll go get to go make a movie, you know? And yet these kids wind up in debt. They come out of film school in debt with a worthless degree. And, you know, and now they got to carve their way out of that. Whereas I'm sort of going, hey, I think there's a way for very little money and with very little risk for you to make tell a story. Now, not every film made for $6,000 is going to be great, but you can make a great film for $6,000. Christopher Nolan did it. Robert Rodriguez did it. The Polish brothers did it. Shane Carruth did it. I mean, the list goes on and on. And so, you know, but nobody's really teaching that. And so I felt that, like, with my experience and a lot of the things that I've learned along the way, I could really help filmmakers who are struggling to tell their stories, help filmmakers that are typically disenfranchised by producers and by, you know, fundraisers, like, you know, who typically cannot go out and get millions of dollars to tell their story. And not only that, show them a way to make their film, but also give them, you know, experience and an education that they can carry with them as their budgets get bigger. You know, everything I learned on Layover, I've applied to every movie I've made, you know, even those with millions of dollars. So, you know, it just was one of those things where I said, I think that there's a place for this. And so far, it's proven to be quite effective. I've had, you know, hundreds of students. They all seem to really love the course. And, you know, that course is continuing to grow and continuing to sell. And so, you know, it's great to see people now also taking what they've learned and actually going out and making their own films.
It is great to see people taking those pieces of advice and making their own work. Joshua Alexander Caldwell, and talking about, for example, this concept of pause button, also reinventing yourself. All of this can happen after a layover in Los Angeles, but also probably after being sent to a veteran affairs facilities, a VAF.
Yes, absolutely. I like that transition. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's people's ability to start over can happen at any point in life. And often you think that you're in a place and your story's written, right? And the truth is, it's not. And one of the ways that is, you know, that I've learned that can be a very specific story is in the military. And, you know, and a lot of guys, they go into the military and they think that is their whole life. That's the story. And then they get injured and they are forced out of the military and they're dealing with the effects of PTSD. They're dealing with their injuries. And they think that the story's over. But, you know, one of the things that was told to me by a former Marine was, you know, basically everybody thinks that's the whole story, but it's not. It's just a chapter. And that kind of sort of that saying really stuck with him. And it really stuck with me as I set out to make my latest film, Mending the Line.
Mending the Line. Joshua Alexander Caldwell is your latest feature film. And I would love to discuss about that piece of art because it was released earlier this year in June 2023 in theaters. And this film is going to be released digitally on September 26th on all the Sony's platforms. Can you tell us a little bit more about Mending the Line?
Yeah, absolutely. So Mending the Line is the story of a veteran, Mending the Line is the story of a Marine who's wounded in Afghanistan, and he's sent to a VA clinic in Montana where he meets an older Vietnam vet who teaches him how to fly fish as a way of dealing with his trauma. And so that movie was made in 2021, released in 2023, as you said, came out in theaters in June. It stars Brian Cox, Cinqua Walls, Patricia Heaton, Perry Matfeld, and Wes Studi. And it's just kind of a really beautiful story about overcoming trauma, about overcoming grief and loss, and the ways in which nature, and specifically fly fishing, can be incredibly healing on your journey And just the impact that relationships can have in your life. And so it was a really beautiful story written by Stephen Camilio. And I was really, really fortunate to be brought on to direct it. And as a fly fisherman myself, it was a wonderful experience to spend months in Montana, not only fly fishing there, but then making a movie about it, making a movie on some of the same rivers and some of the same sort of, locations as a river runs through it, which is the epitome of a fly fishing movie. And so it was a great experience. And one of the things that's been really remarkable for me has been being able to watch this movie with veterans and sit in a theater and feel that the way that they connect to it. And then have a lot of these guys come up to me afterwards and thank me for finally telling a story. Thank Steven and I, not just me, but I mean, it's the whole team, right? The whole producer team, everything. But thank us as a group for finally making a movie that spoke to their experience. And I've had this happen over and over and over again. And obviously the movie's not based on a true story. We definitely borrowed from real life, but it's not based on any one particular soldier's story. But to hear that story, the story that we told, ends up reflecting so many different stories out there is really touching and remarkable. And I'm super proud of the film. And I'm really thrilled with how it's been received, and I'm thrilled with the way that people have been able to connect to it. And so we were in theaters in June, and like you said, it'll be out on all digital platforms to rent or buy on September 26th.
Furthermore, this is the reason why I think that this is not a movie, but the movie, because this is the alliance and the combination of, are your two biggest centers of interest, fly fishing, because I can see that this is what you do a lot of your time.
Yeah.
But also filmmaking. This is the ultimate movie by Joshua Alexander Caldwell.
Exactly. I mean, I hope it's not the top of the pile, right? Like, I got a long way to go in my career, but I mean, it was funny when I originally went to like so many of my collaborators, my DP and everything, and told them about the picture. They're like, "Did you write this?" And I'm like, "No, I had nothing to do with. I didn't come up with this story. I didn't write it." And everybody's like, "If you were like, this just feels like such a you movie." And I said, "I'm just really lucky that I got to be on it." But yes, it's true. I mean, I'm a fly fisherman. I was a fly fisherman before the movie. But that's where you just that's the weird, strange thing about life, right? Like this movie came to me so randomly. I didn't know Steven. Basically, one of the producers reached out to my manager. She was trying to connect with people that had made movies in Montana. And my manager had made a movie that was set in Montana, but they didn't film it in Montana. But he asked about the film, and she told him, and he said, "Do you have a director?" And she said, "No." And he asked if they could send it to me. And so I pitched on it, and I really, really wanted to do it. But like, if my manager, 5 years ago, had not been a producer on that one film that took place in Montana, but wasn't shot in Montana, this movie might never have landed on my doorstep. And so that's the odd thing. And I've only been fly fishing for like 6 years now. I didn't start till I moved to New York. So, to have something like that land in your lap and cross your desk, I was like, I've got to do this. Like, I don't know if I would ever be okay if I didn't get to direct this film. And so, and it was a chance to do it right, right? It was a chance to really make sure that the sport that I love and this thing that I'm incredibly passionate about is portrayed accurately on screen.
Absolutely, Joshua Alexander Caldwell. And you just mentioned that word, sport, because fly fishing is a sport. And I would love to know more about the training that all the actors had on set, because it can be very physical. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah. The thing about fly fishing is that there's a lot of technique involved, right? People, when you think of fishing, you think of something, you typically think of spin fishing, which is when you've got your rod and you just kind of toss it out and you're just reeling in, right? Fly fishing is not that. Like, fly fishing is casting the fly, which is usually this little, feathers and hair tied around a hook. It doesn't weigh anything. So you got to cast this thing that doesn't weigh anything. And you do that with a line that is weighted. So the fly line itself is weighted. And that is what you're casting back and forth. And there's a very precise way to do it. And it takes practice, right? And so unfortunately on this movie, we just did not have months to train our actors. We had maybe days if we were lucky, but we had to have them casting well. So we were really fortunate. One of the companies, there's a fly fishing company called Sage. They make fly rods and reels and things like that. And they have a sort of education and events program that's led by this fly fisherman named Simon Gosworth. Simon is like a world record fly fisherman. He's an amazing caster and he's a great teacher. And we got to have him on set training all of our actors on how to cast fly rods. And so I know he spent days with Brian in upstate New York teaching him how to cast his fly rod. And then in Montana, because we had the actors there early, he spent time on the rivers with them teaching them how to do it. And, you know, all of them picked it up very easily. I thought they did a great job for so little, you know. I mean, I've been fly fishing for 6 years and I'm still working on getting my cast right, you know? So it's not something that just comes naturally to people and it's not something that happens easily. But you know, they all actors are one, they're trained to learn new things very easily. So they're really, really good at picking stuff up. And also it helps when you've got one of the best, you know, fly fishing casters in the world teaching these guys how to do it. So, we were really fortunate that at every level on this film, we had the right people or the right company in the right place helping us make sure that it was authentic and accurate and that we were portraying, you know, the sport that we all love in the best way possible.
Having the right people in all levels of production is very important, as you just mentioned, Joshua Alexander Caldwell, because you had the best teachers, but also the best equipment. And by having this equipment, I truly feel in your voice that you were supporting Montana's entire economy, for example, with a partnership with Sims, giving you the clothing, Forbank, Reddington fishing gears and Rio Lines, and also Tom Morgan Road Smith, making you locally some very strong bamboo rods.
Yeah, absolutely. Those rods were really cool. I mean, the bamboo rods that Brian uses in the movie, retail for like $4,000 or something like that. And so Tom Morgan Rodsmiths, which is a Bozeman-based rod company, hand-built two rods for the film. And I got to keep one of them, which is pretty cool.
I am now Joshua Caldwell thinking of taking that rods, reselling it, and then make another movie.
Yeah, make another layover. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Right now, I think I'll hold on to the rod for a little bit.
Absolutely. And to come back to the core and the beginning of the storyline and the writing process, you worked, as you just mentioned, with writer Stephen Camelio. Did you have different meaning of the word mending because this is the verb that is on the title?
Yeah, so mending the line is a technique in fly fishing. It's an actual technique called mend the line or mending the line. And it involves how you move the line on the water in order to protect the fly, right? So naturally, like, you're going to gravitate towards something that means something to fly fishing. But on a bigger scale, yeah, mending, the word mending. Like, I mean, we are, you know, every character in the film is in the process of healing, of mending something that is broken inside of them, whatever that might be. And so it has definitely many, many meanings. And I'm sure there's a lot of audience members that have taken something completely different out of it. It was there from the beginning. The big question was whether, you know, sometimes in filmmaking, in independent filmmaking, you get partnered with a distributor and they want to change the title. And they want to change the title to something that is closer to the beginning of the alphabet, mainly because when they believe that when they put stuff up on like on demand or iTunes, people search alphabetically, it's going to be up there versus down in the M's or the whatever, you know, and they're never going to get to it. But fortunately, we really didn't have a better title. And so, you know, from the beginning, this was called Mending the Line, and it stayed Mending the Line the whole time. And we were really fortunate with both Blue Fox and Sony that they weren't like, you got to change the title. So no, we're very happy with it.
You're very happy with it and with the title. And now, each second that I am talking with you, I am learning a lot about fly fishing, but also about producing, because this movie would never start with a letter Z,
nope.
Like zipping the line.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, if you want to make an independent film, start your title with the number one or something in the A's, and you won't have a distributor trying to change it, you know?
Absolutely. And you just mentioned Joshua Alexander Caldwell, that Mending the Line is literally a fishing technique, which is something that I didn't knew about. But in the more traditional sense and meaning of that word, to mend means to repair or fix something that is damaged, broken, and in the state of disrepair. And this verb can also apply not only to objects and clothing, but also, and this is the case in this movie, to feelings, relationships, and situations.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to mend, you know, to mend a relationship, to mend, you know, hurt feelings, right? I mean, in our case, we've got numerous characters who are, you know, experiencing trauma, who are suffering in some way, who are, I don't like the word broken, but, you know, they've been through a very challenging ordeal, you know, and, you know, I think we're all in the process of trying to heal. I mean, I think one of the things that really spoke to me about this film was the timing of it. You know, I mean, we sort of as a collective group of humans just went through a massively traumatic time period, right, with COVID. And, you know, so to tell a story that was about processing and healing and sort of, you know, overcoming and addressing and sort of, you know, was also like a nice story. It just felt really right for that movie to come out when it did.
Absolutely. Joshua Alexander Caldwell. And I would love now to discuss about how this journey in filmmaking started, because you like very much to be behind the scenes, for example, whether behind the cameras or behind the fishing the fishing lines. Can you tell us about this idea of directing that started a long time ago?
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned, you know, at the beginning of this, I've always had an interest in film. You know, it's just always been something really exciting to me. And my dad had a love for movies and would often like take me and my brother to go see, you know, whatever we could. And you know, but at the time, as I mentioned with like Huckleberry Finn or whatever, is like I had a real interest in like I wanted to be the character. Right. Like, so I wanted to be Batman or I wanted to be Robin Hood or I wanted to be whatever. But it wasn't so much like I wanted to be an actor. Right. It was more like I just wanted to exist as Batman. And what would happen was we'd come back. And like I said before, we would get the neighborhood kids together and we would play act these movies for whatever, for weeks, you know, whatever it was. And I realized at the time that I was basically like directing. Right. I was gathering the kids. I was setting the scene. And yeah, I was playing the lead, quote unquote, but I wasn't, you know, but it was like getting everybody together and organizing the whole thing. And, you know, I was always into Legos and world building and all that kind of stuff, but I never really processed what a director meant. I didn't even know they existed. And then when I got into my teenage years, I saw a web series. I saw a TV series on Discovery Channel called Movie Magic. And it was really cool. It was like a weekly series, but I never knew when it was on. And this was during the time of cable when you just like, you had to go on when it was being, you know, broadcast. You couldn't just like watch it on Netflix or anything like that. And so I try and capture, you know, I try and like see it on TV and I try and tape it on a VHS. And, but what was cool about the series was it was all about the behind the scenes special effects of movies. So each episode was about like model building or animatronics or makeup or like anything like that. And they would take you through like how they did the special effects on Terminator 2 or Jurassic Park or like any of these Apollo 13, any of these really cool movies. And it was my first glimpse at like sort of the behind the scenes look at filmmaking. And it really just grew from there. And I was fortunate that in high school, we had two things that were really formative for me. One, we had a two-period-a-day video production class where we had Avid editing systems and digital cameras, and we had the means to actually practice the craft of filmmaking. But the other thing that was really big for me was our school had a history of making parody films. So our school ASB officers, which were like, you know, the president, vice president, school officers, for a long time before I even got involved with it, would make these parody films. They would take the film that was in the theater and they would make a joke parody film out of it. And I would see these at the assemblies and just be like, this is amazing. How do I get involved? And I was really fortunate that a friend of mine, a very, very close friend of mine, got involved somehow. He was a year older than me. So he got involved right before I got to high school. And it was like, I was like begging him, I'll do anything. I just want to help you. And so I got involved in that. And so what was really awesome about it was we got to go make these films. And then we got to show them to like 1,200 kids at an assembly. And so you had no money, you had a deadline, and you had to figure it out. And you had to entertain 1,200 kids for 20 minutes or a half hour or whatever the film was. And it was just cool to not only, look, I think a lot of people get to make movies, but you don't often get to screen it for audiences. And so that was a really huge part. And it just was, I just fell in love with filmmaking and I knew that that was what I wanted to do. And so, you know, then I eventually went to Fordham University in New York City, mainly for the experience of living in New York City. Kept making movies on my own, got to know some really fantastic actors. Fordham had a really fantastic acting program. And a lot of kids that were either in my class or the class above me have gone on to become, you know, pretty recognizable actors in Hollywood. And, you know, just continued doing it and continued working on it. And really, really just like since high school, this has been the only thing that I've done and the only thing I've really wanted to do.
You got involved, Joshua Alexander Caldwell, in those history of making a parodies film and using and learning by having a direct contact with the digital cameras that you mentioned, also the Avid editing systems. And to come back to the location, I feel that whether this is upstate New York with the Hudson Bay or in Montana, this is giving you a lot of space to think, but also a lot of space physically with a lot of nature, whether this is for fishing, but also to have creative and visual ideas with nature.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a big reason why we moved. I lived in LA for 10 years. There's a lot of LA I really love and really miss, but I found myself constantly looking to escape it. You know, I would say to myself, oh, maybe I could take a week or 2 weeks and get a cabin up in Big Bear and go write or go somewhere else and write. But it was always like this temporary thing until it was sort of like, well, why not just make that make that where you are all the time. And I really was seeking not so much an escape, but an ability to have nature very close by. And, you know, in LA, you can certainly find nature, but like everything in LA, you got to drive to go there. You know, so in LA, you got to, you know, if you want a culture, fine, but you got to drive to go there. You want to explore a neighborhood, fine, but you got to drive to go there. Nature, fine, but you got to drive to go there. And, you know, we came back to New York because my wife's family's from here. And so we saw it as a viable option. But when we were looking at where to live, that was a big part of it. And having the ability to be amidst nature, to raise my kids amidst nature, and to step outside onto your porch or you know, right out front and just be surrounded by, you know, trees and green and this kind of beautiful world around you just became so refreshing. And so I don't regret moving at all. It's been huge for me. I mean, my career is still going great. Hasn't impacted that, not being in LA. And, you know, I know that a lot of people, I really am really thankful that we were here, especially during COVID, because, you know, I mean, we had a lot of space. Like, we had plenty of room. We didn't feel constrained. I could only imagine if we were in, like, the condo that we lived in LA during that time. That would have been really challenging for us. So, yeah, I mean, I think that, like, fly fishing is a big part of it, the ability to be out in a river and feel the power of nature around you is incredibly refreshing, and it's healing. It gives you the space to think, but also to not think. And, you know, and allows you to have space, you know, and clear your head. And so it's incredibly therapeutic.
It is very therapeutic. And also this idea of feeling nature. And in conclusion, you took that 4-acre cabin in Big Bear, as you just mentioned, and made it your own home. A little bit like this idea of freedom that Mark Twain wrote in The Adventure of Huckleberry Finn. Thank you very much, Joshua Alexander Caldwell.
Thanks, Victor. It was a great chat. I really appreciate it.